Bova's appearance, I'm very pleased to say he's with me now. Ben Bova is probably one of the country's best-known science fiction writers and editors. He's received 5 Hugo Awards for his work as editor for 5 consecutive years, from 1973 to 1977. He's the former editor of Analog Magazine, and currently the science fiction editor of Omni Magazine, a magazine of science and science fiction. Ben Bova is also the author of about 40 books, including Colony, Millennia, and a new book called Kinsmen, which involves space warfare. Ben Bova, I'm glad you made it here.
I'm glad to be here. It's a little embarrassing for a science fiction writer to be stuck in traffic on Chestnut Street, but that's about what happened.
Well, look at the present when you're worrying about the future. Well, your new book, can you tell us the basic structure of it?
Sure. Kinsmen is a character that has been with me for more than 30 years now, and the novel titled Kinsman is about his early life. It begins right here and now. It's written for people who don't ordinarily read science fiction, and I'd like to think it's a very realistic treatment of one young man who joins the Air Force to become an astronaut and rather unwittingly brings a military presence into space.
Do you see that as happening?
Oh, yes, it's happening right now.
In what way?
That's why the novel is set right now.
Yeah. In what ways do you see that happening?
First of all, the only reason we're in space is because back in the 1950s, both the Soviet Union and the United States began to develop long-distance intercontinental ballistic rockets. These missiles are major weapons of our strategic arsenal. We then used those rockets and that technology to begin to boost satellites into orbit for a variety of purposes, some military, many of them peaceful. We are putting more and more of our economic and social well-being in space. We have satellite communications. We have weather observation satellites within the past month that have saved thousands of lives with their tracking of the hurricanes that have hit the islands and the mainland. As space operations become more important to us, and by us I mean the whole human race, the people who own these satellites will want to protect them from other people who may want to destroy them. Now, the Russians have a capability to destroy satellites. They've shown this. They have a satellite killer system. They have blinded a couple of our observation satellites, presumably with laser beams that blanked out the optics on the cameras. And we are developing satellite killer systems, too. There, you know, whenever you have something of value, you must protect it because someone else might want to take it away from you or prevent you from using it. So it's inevitable, given the kind of world we have here on the surface of the Earth, that we will carry a military presence into space.
When you talk about a militaristic presence in space, to what extent do you see that as being aggression aimed back at the Earth, and to what
100%.
Extent? 100%. Uh-huh.
I'm not sure that aggression is the right word, but it is totally based on terrestrial politics. My novel Millennium talks about what happens when you have a group of Americans and Russians living on the moon side by side, very interdependent, and the moon is such a dangerous place that they need each other to survive. And yet on the surface of the Earth, the United States and the Soviet Union are on the brink of a shooting war. What happens to Americans and Russians on the moon? And in the novel, the way it worked out is that these people on the moon begin to think of themselves as residents of the moon, not Americans or Russians, but as human beings who live a quarter of a million miles away and will not kill themselves because of the politics on Earth. And in fact, begin to shape the politics on Earth because of their peculiar strategic situation.
How has the recent space missions left you feeling about possible colonization of other planets or moons?
Well, I think one of the big inventions we've made, and largely through Gerard O'Neill and his students at Princeton University, the idea of building space colonies, gigantic structures in empty space, means that we probably won't colonize the planets themselves. We will certainly put some factories and mining operations on the moon, because the moon is a dead hunk of very valuable rock and metal. But the old idea of putting a colony on Mars or putting a colony on this planet or that planet is no longer necessary. You can put immense colonies that are completely Earth-like in their interiors, to the extent of having hills and valleys and lakes and streams and trees and birds flying in the air. You can put them in orbit around any part of the solar system you want to be near. So your Martian colony may be actually a large manufactured colony in space placed in orbit around Mars, so you don't disturb the surface of the planet. I think we have an ecological movement here on Earth. We should certainly be very, very careful about tinkering with the ecology of other worlds, especially if there's any chance that there's anything living on those worlds.
Well, how do you possibly send out self-contained environments
and expect it
to not interfere?
Oh, you don't land on the planet. You may put a few explorers down there, but you don't put a colony down there. You don't build flush toilets and you know, on the surface of Mars. What you do build is a structure many miles across, and fill it with earth and landscape it, and you can carry thousands of people in it. And this essentially becomes your home. You can travel through the solar system with it or park it in a particular part of the solar system. There's a whole organization called the L5 Society because they want to build space colonies in a position between the Earth and the Moon that astronomers call the L5 point. It's a stable point where if you put an object there, it will remain equidistant between the Earth and the Moon.
Would you want to live in one of the early space colonies if it happened in your lifetime?
It probably won't happen, colonies of that size, but I certainly would want to give it a shot. I've convinced NASA to put me on the first space shuttle that's safe for science fiction writers.
So, when do you think that's going to be?
I would think about 83 or 84,
really?
Somewhere around there. Yeah.
Well, what is it? The space shuttle now that keeps getting delayed.
It's been delayed.
18 months
it's been delayed. Yes.
More?
Well, it's the old story that back in the beginning of the program, they saved 50 cents here and a dollar there. And as a result, the program has developed much more slowly and has run into more problems than it would have if they had devoted the proper amount of manpower and attention to it in the early days. The same reason we lost Skylab. Something like $50,000 expenditure in the beginning of that program would have put that Skylab into a high enough orbit so that it wouldn't have come back.
So you'd like to see more money being...
I'd like to see more intelligence being applied to our space program. We unfortunately have a political system whereby most of the people making decisions are totally unaware of what we can do in space and out of sympathy with it. You have idiots like Senator Proxmire running around, shouting that the science costs too much money and we've got to stop it. I notice Proxmire has never complained about cosmetic science, you know, hair transplants, because he got one and it made him look more youthful and he got a younger chick with it. But all other kinds of science he seems to be against.
When you are working on an idea or developing a new tool or a new concept, if it's working for the government, I think you're probably never quite sure how it's going to be used. And I figure that a lot of people have found that their ideas, which were originally intended for a more peaceful society, have ultimately been used for militaristic purposes. I know,
and vice versa.
And
too.
Vice versa. You did research and development for a while, or at least consulted.
Well, I've worked with some of the top physicists in the country and in the world, and worked at a research laboratory where I was the marketing manager. I was sort of the resident science fiction writer. Robert Oppenheimer, I think, said it best, if I can remember the way he said it. He said, when you see something in science that is technically sweet, you go ahead and do it and have your technical success first, and then you worry what they're going to do with it afterward. It is, you know, a scientist is seeking knowledge, and very seldom does he look far enough ahead to worry about how that knowledge will be used. Over the long haul, if you take a long look at history, the knowledge that scientists have uncovered has almost inevitably been to the benefit of the majority of the human race. Yeah, you uncover nuclear energy and people make nuclear bombs out of it. But in New England, nuclear energy keeps our electric bills down low. And when most of the rest of the Midwest was freezing to death because they couldn't get natural gas a couple of winters ago, in New England, we were quite comfortable.
So in the period of time when you were working, consulting with with industry or, or with the government. You didn't really adhere to any political system at that time.
Oh.
Because you were into science aspects of it.
No. The laboratory that I worked with prided itself on working on impure science. We worked on things that would have an impact on the public. In 1959, we developed the first MHD power generator, a machine that would take fossil fuel of the dirtiest kind, you know, high sulfur coal, and produce electricity very cleanly at about a third less cost to the consumer. That system has never been deployed in the United States. It's being used in Russia, but not here, largely because even though it works on an experimental basis, in the mid-1960s, the work was halted in the United States. No major corporation, no government agency, and certainly no electric utility wanted to develop a more efficient power generator. They're very happy with the inefficient machines they have today. They're very happy sticking you with higher and higher bills. So here's a part of science and technology that we have that could have been developed, that could have been deployed now, could have been cutting your electric bills by at least a third, and yet it's not. It never happened.
Let's talk a little bit, Ben Bover, about your work as a science fiction editor. You have been an editor at Analog and are now the science fiction editor of Omni magazine.
Yes.
Do you have any guidelines as to what makes a good science fiction story?
Same things that make a good story of any kind. Believable people doing interesting things. In science fiction, these people may not always be human, and certainly where they're doing their interesting things is not always on the Earth or always in the present. It's very often in the future and some other planet. But at heart, you see, what a writer does is play a little game with the reader. The writer is trying to make you forget that you're sitting in an uncomfortable chair, squinting at some characters on paper, and the writer wants you to, momentarily at least, believe that you are part of the story, that you're living this experience. So you must write a story about characters that the reader would like to be, or at least would like to know. This is why many times experimental writing and writing about really downbeat, grungy characters never finds a very large audience, because it just isn't fun. You know, Homer figured out how to write an interesting story, and we've been doing the same thing ever since.
How complicated can the science aspects of a science fiction story be, do you think, and still hold a non-scientific audience?
Well, people are much more sophisticated about science and technology today than they were even 10 years ago. For Analog, which is very much a specialty magazine, going to the specialized science fiction audience, you can get quite complex. You know, there are stories that had equations in them, and in some cases more equations than prose. For Omni magazine, which is bought every month now by about 1 million people, that's a much wider audience, and we cannot be so specialized. We must present stories that are fascinating and interesting, but accessible, understandable to people. What I've told the writers time and time again is this. If you start to write a story with a line such as, "The warp ship popped out of hyperspace 11 parsecs from Aldebaran 9, every science fiction fan in the world knows exactly what you mean. But only science fiction fans would know what you mean. Most of the readers of Omni would be quite puzzled at a sentence like that. So you have to choose your language carefully and write for an audience that is interested and alert, but not knowledgeable in the jargon of science and science fiction.
There's a lot of aspects of science fiction that has probably changed in interesting ways over the past decade or two. The role of women, for instance, do you see the way women are being treated by authors as characters within the stories as having changed a lot since, say, the last 10 years?
I think so, and I think this is largely because women themselves have gotten up off their duffs and contributed to the field and demanded the attention of the readers and the editors. You cannot have a situation in which a group of people are poorly dealt with if those people will not take it. And it took a while and a whole complex of things to happen, mainly what happened with women in science fiction was that 40 years ago, 30, 20 years ago, there were very few women interested in science fiction or in science. But that has all changed. There are no locked doors anymore that are opened only by one gender.
No, I spoke on the program on Friday with two women who do comics, one who's at Marvel and works with superhero comics, another one who's into, she writes ElfQuest, which is a fantasy comic. Do you see any connection between science fiction and those kinds of comics, since they're both very
no
much
really
into
strong
fantasy,
connection.
And they're both also geared
no,
for...
No, 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 no. Science fiction is not into fantasy. Science fiction is the only realistic literature we have.
Uh-huh. What do you mean by that?
Well, all other literature deals with the past. Every other story you read, a story about what's happening here today, by the time it's published, is months or perhaps years old. And it is talking about the past, the way things used to be. So-called contemporary literature is talking about the past. It may be the very recent past, but it is essentially a rehashing of things that have already happened. Science fiction is looking into the future. And science fiction now, as opposed to other forms of futuristic fiction, such as fantasy, science fiction tries to do it in as realistic a way as possible. That's why it's called science fiction. It deals with the best method we have of predicting the future, and that is the scientific method.
Do you enjoy reading old science fiction stories from 20 or 30 years ago that had visions of the future very much rooted in its own time?
No. I find them pretty dull.
Why?
Because
stylistically
place,
or because of the vision?
Many times the style, the writing style is pretty poor, but mostly they just don't have anything to say that is interesting to a contemporary reader. They were wrong, you know, and the future that they were dealing with never came to pass. There may be some alternate universe in which that future did come to pass, and those stories are very prophetic. But even in stories in our universe that are prophetic, again, you're no longer reading about the future, you're reading about the past.
When you're, again, as an editor, reading someone's story whose work you don't know yet, when do you stop? And I imagine you stop reading more stories than you finish.
I try to finish all of them, and it's not a matter of stopping. It's a matter of how fast do you read, how quickly do you skim through it. When you're getting 100 or so manuscripts per week, you read most of them very, very quickly, and they've got to be interesting right off the bat. Many times a new writer, and by new I mean literally new, not necessarily young. In science fiction, many people turn to the field in their later years. But new writers frequently will develop ideas as the story goes on. So if you simply read the first page or so and it's not interesting, you may be missing a good idea and a potentially good writer. So you do riffle through the pages. And I admit sometimes it almost goes supersonically. But I try to get through every story and see if there's anything in there that's really of value.
Let's talk a little bit about your own writing. You've written, what, over 40?
I think the number is 48 right now.
That's considerably over 40. Do you have favorites amongst your own works?
I suppose so, for different reasons. Millennium was a book that took about 25 years to produce, and after that much time spent on it, certainly it's very close to me. The novel Kinsman is a prequel to Millennium. Millennium deals with the later years of this character, Chet Kinsman, and the novel Kinsman deals with his early years. You put them together and you have pretty much his whole life. A book I wrote called The Star-Crossed originated in a fairly strange way. I was a science consultant for a television science fiction series. Beyond doubt, the worst series of any kind that has ever been on commercial television.
Oh, I've probably seen it. What is it?
It was called The Star-Lost. And Cure Delay. No, it received a mercy killing after seven episodes. But being science advisor for this group of zanies consisted of reading the scripts, pointing out where the technical inaccuracies were, and there were some on every script, and suggesting ways to overcome them without having to go back to zero and write a totally new script. I gave the advice, I was thanked for it, I was paid very handsomely for it, and none of the advice was ever paid the slightest bit of attention. So that all the technical lunacies came out on the screen, followed by a credit that says Science Advisor Ben Bova. That perturbed me, and I wrote a novel called The Star-Crossed, which was sort of inspired by the idiocies of doing this dumb show on television. And the book has been fairly well received. It's a funny, funny book. And it's shameful, but when the galley proofs came back from the printer for me to read, I was alone in my apartment and that night, and I started just glancing at them around midnight, and by 2 a.m, I was literally rolling on the living room floor, laughing at my own prose, but mainly because it brought back to mind the original events that inspired that prose.
I wonder what inspires a company or an organization, scriptwriters, whatever, to hire someone at a handsome fee for a consultant and then to ignore their advice.
It's ritual thinking. We all go through this, and organizations especially. If you have a science advisor and someone comes and says, gee, your show is really dumb, you know, the science is all wrong, they say, oh, we have a science advisor, you see? So they feel it's sort of like thinking out of the Neolithic era. If you have someone with that title, then you're protected.
Yeah.
And you don't have to worry about it.
Do you think a lot about the future in nonfiction terms?
Oh, yes. Yes. All the science fiction I write really starts with my estimation of the future in nonfiction terms. The difference between science fiction and the professional futurologists, for example, is that we carry it one step further. The futurologist will try to come up with an acceptable prediction or an envelope of predictions about certain facets of the future. And they're always wrong. And the reason they're always wrong is that they are required to stick to the facts. Now, science fiction writers don't have to stick to the facts. We can throw in the crazy ideas and the wild cards. And if you play the game long enough, the wild card always turns up. So that as you look farther and farther into the future, the predictions made by the professional futurologists get wronger and wronger, and the predictions made in science fiction stories look better and better.
You want to give us some examples?
No futurologist predicted the energy crisis when there was a chance to do anything about it. Read Herman Kahn's The Year 2000, which was published, I think, in 1966. Not a word about anything that really has changed things between 66 and 79. Just totally dumb. The assumption is that here we are today and the future will be sort of like this, the way things are today. Bad move. Nobody could predict or would have dared to predict outside of fiction in, say, 1960, that American politics would be so radicalized by the events of the 60s. None of those crew-cut specialists in the 50s had the slightest inkling of what was going to happen.
It's a little hard to judge with science fiction, isn't it, how accurate it is in its predictions of the future, since most of the predictions are
the real joke is that science fiction writers are not trying to predict the future. And indeed, I don't think many of us believe there is a single future that can be predicted. The future is an infinite variety of possibilities. And science fiction stories show scenarios based on certain assumptions. You know, if this trend is continued or accelerated, here's the kind of future that may develop.
Have you ever thought of, like, what would happen if there were space colonies that were being run by, like, fast food franchises or something? Who are some of the people who have the most money around now, but who...
No, the most money is by the people who own the fast food franchises.
Yes,
and those are largely
right.
Energy companies
and
food companies. Yeah, my novel Colony deals with just that. Space Colony, the first space colony in this novel, is built by a consortium of multinational corporations, specifically as an escape hatch for them, because things are getting so bad on Earth, largely because of their own machinations, that they want a nice, safe hideaway, a luxurious hideaway, too.
Well, that's it, luxurious. The things that I've seen and read in science fiction are always spectacular and luxurious, very gleaming and metallic.
Well, sometimes there are other visions in science fiction where things are more organic,
yeah,
and even grungy in some cases.
What about tacky and just, you know, commercial and cheap? Yeah.
You don't need science fiction for that. Just look out the window.
But in fact, look
in the window.
As someone who really thinks, though, about what might be happening, do you see that as a possibility?
Oh, sure, sure. There are all sorts of writers who have predicted all sorts of futures. One of the classic novels of the 1950s, it was originally called Gravy Planet, and then it was retitled The Space Merchants, written by Fred Pohl and Cyril Kornbluth. in which the major corporations, including advertising agencies, take over the political machinery in the United States, so that we no longer in the Senate have a senator from Pennsylvania. We have a senator from Coca-Cola. And that's a pretty tacky, grungy America.
A lot of the science fiction that many Americans see now is movies, things like...
No, they don't see science fiction in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Fantasy, not science fiction.
Comic strip.
Uh-huh.
They see old, well, some fantasy, some horror, like Alien, which is sort of Bela Lugosi in drag, and Star Wars, which is just Bugs Bunny in space. You know, there's very little science fiction of the kind that I'm talking about has ever been done in the films.
Why do you think that is?
Because the movies... Well, let's back up just a second. Science fiction as a literature tends to make people think. It challenges your assumptions. It tries to shake you up. Motion pictures, where you're investing millions and millions of dollars, must be aimed at the broadest possible audience to sell the most possible tickets, and television even more so. So they don't want to shake you up. They don't want to make you think. They just want to keep you lightly entertained. So you buy the tickets or you watch the TV screen until the commercial comes on. And that means they cannot do the real strong kinds of science fiction that we take for granted on the printed page. Stanley Kubrick's film, 2001, A Space Odyssey, was darn good science fiction. And yet I stood outside the theater. I saw it several times in the theaters. And I specifically stood outside and listened to what people were saying as they came out. And the ones who weren't already stoned were saying, what does it mean? Why? I don't like that. I don't understand what he was trying to do. Now, the film was trying to make you think and come to some conclusions on your own.
Well, let's face it, it was so symbolic, like seeing an embryo and an egg on a planet at the end. You have to walk out and say, oh, come on, what did he mean?
Yeah.
By that, he asks you to ask that question.
Yes.
And he's pretty obtuse in giving you the answer.
Arthur Clarke, you know, wrote the basic screenplay or the screen treatment and wrote a novel about 2001 in which everything is explained quite clearly.
Right. And it comes across, so much more explicit.
Yeah. And it's much, much weaker for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's much better to let the audience think. Now, 2001... was a spectacular film, but was not a big success in the minds of the businessmen who run the movie industry. It sold a lot of tickets, but it cost an awful lot of money to produce. Michael Crichton's movie Westworld, which came out at about the same time with Yul Brynner playing the part of a robot, which is about Yul Brynner's speed, that cost very little to make and sold as many tickets as 2001 did. That convinced the money people that there's gold in science, what they call science fiction.
Hmm.
And they went on to do things like Star Wars and Close Encounters of the Third Kind and now Alien. It's more, largely, when you look at those films, Star Wars, Close Encounters, Alien, they're about dummies. They're really about stupid people. Damon Knight years ago coined a phrase, the idiot plot. He said, you can only believe this story is happening if you assume that all the characters in it are idiots. And there you have it. I mean, Close Encounters is about a guy who can't even find his way in his own truck through his own town. and you know, eventually finds aliens through no fault of his own. Alien is about people who constantly look stage right whenever the monster's coming up stage left. And are, you know, I have yet to believe that the way to drive an alien out of your spacecraft is to go through the... access tubes of the spacecraft with a flamethrower. That's like, you know, trying to kill a cockroach in a 707 with hand grenades.
Have you given up thinking that we'll find life on other planets?
No, I think we found it already. We just don't recognize it.
Uh-huh.
I think the results from the first Viking experiments on Mars are equivocal and perhaps show something that isn't quite chemistry and certainly is not the same as terrestrial biology, which might be just the place where extraterrestrial biology would fit in. We need to do a lot more digging on Mars, carefully, and maybe there is life there. I'm willing to bet that there is life beneath those clouds of Jupiter, and in fact, those beautiful colors on the Jovian clouds may be the result of biological processes.
Let me just ask you a question that you cannot answer. It's a hard one, very general. But are you optimistic about the future? Certainly some people will tell you that before we really get much further into the future, we'll probably blow ourselves up atomic weaponry or nuclear reactors or something or another. Chemical poisoning, there's always chemicals pouring into water supplies all over. People in various counties around here are being forced to drink bottled water. There seems to be dangers all around us.
Oh, there's always dangers, but we are a species that has outlasted the saber-toothed tiger and ice ages and all sorts of conflicts. If you really want to see militarism, think back to the days when armies armed with sharp knives killed each other and then wiped out deliberately, one by one, hand by hand, the whole populations of whole cities. Dismantled those cities, brick by brick, diverted rivers over the site of the cities. We have been pretty mean to each other and somehow have survived it. And I think we certainly have the knowledge and the skill and the heart to survive the problems we have today. I think we're expanding into space. We are a space-borne species. We no longer live only on the surface of the Earth. And we'll survive and we'll thrive, too.